The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It was a day like any other in America. 355 of them this year, anyway.
Hi, this is Barbara Gordon. I'm calling from Willamette, Oregon. The shooting today is just heartbreaking. What is there to say? And what more can be said?
Barbara reached out to us yesterday as police were chasing the suspects, a married couple in that San Bernardino, California shooting. They were eventually killed after a police chase, and the president who spoke today didn't have much more to add.
We do not yet know why this terrible event occurred. We do know that the two individuals who were killed were equipped with weapons and appeared to have access to additional weaponry at their homes. But we don't know why they did it.
We don't know why this married couple yesterday morning walked armed and masked into a crowded room where a holiday party was going on the campus of a facility that deals with people with disabilities and began shooting, killing at least 14, injuring at least 17.
The only thing I'm comfortable saying at this point is that the information we have is that they came prepared to do what they did as if they were on a mission.
That's San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Bergwan. As we mentioned, the 355th shooting of the year, another community lost in the aftermath of violence once again. Joining me now is Oliver Jones, a journalist based in Los Angeles. He's been reporting from San Bernardino since yesterday afternoon. Oliver, what do we know about the suspects? Tell us anything about the police presence as you came upon the neighborhood where the family lives yesterday.
While you walk into the neighborhood in Redlands where they live, and last night it was trash night, right? All of the barrels were out, and you know you see the Christmas lights on. It's just a neighborhood like any others, and suddenly you think to yourself, "My gosh, there could be an explosive device in one of those barrels," right? I mean, right down the street at a driveway is a SWAT vehicle, the kind of militarized vehicles that we've become increasingly alarmed seeing local police with, but doing exactly what it's designed to do, sending a robot in to deal with explosive devices and dangerous devices. You never get comfortable or used to, you know, sounds like a shotgun blast, which I heard at 6:30 last night outside the Redlands, California home this couple shared.
How are people in the community dealing with the detail of the names of these individuals? They're U.S. born, Syed Rizwan Farouk, his wife Tashfeen Malik. But certainly this leads people to speculate about other kinds of motives that relate to ethnicity and that sort of thing. How is the community handling that? How is the family handling that?
I mean, things have been moving so quickly. When I visited a relative of one of the shooters yesterday. I mean, there was rice cooking. The lights were bright. It was just a sort of lovely, welcoming home. I kind of wanted to come in and just have a bowl of rice and a cup of tea. And it seemed to me that the man did not exactly know what was going on yet. He was not any different from you or me or anyone else puttering about their house after coming home from work.
Sure, an expression of shock that this had happened, a sense
I would say more just befuddlement, and I don't believe he understood completely how his family might have been involved in this case. But again, you know, talking to neighbors in by the Redlands home, of course you hear this again and again, but nothing stood out. These are our neighbors. These are our friends. This is you. And I mean, that there may be differences that stand out to some people, but when you get close to the scene, what really tends to hit you is the sameness, and that what is ever causing these certain people to choose to commit crimes like this, those people, they're us. And that's really hard to understand, and that's hard to take.
Here's Farhan Khan, the brother-in-law of one of the suspects, Saeed Farooq, who gave a press conference last night.
I have no idea. I have no idea. Why would he do that? Why would he do something like this? I have absolutely no idea. I'm in shock myself.
That befuddlement that you describe is evident in Farhan Khan's statement there. What about a sense of vulnerability in the broad community of San Bernardino today?
I think we're feeling that across the world, aren't we? I think that in, you know, when often in these communities, when these things happen, it's almost easier for them to pull together than it is for the rest of us.
Well, there's a ritual to that, pulling together, to the sense of fear, to the vulnerability, to the sense of speechlessness. I totally understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, arriving at what I presume was the father of one of these suspects and smelling this delicious food cooking in his house and seeing the boxes from new appliances, you know, sort of freshly opened in the foyer. I mean, it could have been your house. It could have been my house. It's odd.
Any sense of the dead at this point and the victims?
I haven't heard. I went through everything and I haven't, but I certainly know a lot about these types of centers and the services that they provide. You know, I have a member of my family. My nephew is autistic. These are centers that people rely on in this state. In a huge way, they are game changers and lifesavers for families. For something like this to happen in a place like that, and you have to realize, you go through communities like this. What do you see? Right, you see Jersey Mike's sub shops, and you see chain restaurants, and you see less and less libraries, and you see the public spaces and parks being taken over by football fields. These sort of community spaces are becoming less and less in California and in the country. And for such a crucial community space to become a scene for something as unimaginable like this, I think that's why this is hitting everyone so hard today.
Oliver Jones is a journalism professor at the Emerson College campus in Los Angeles, talking about the bloody scene and the terrible aftermath of the shooting at the Inland Regional Health Center, where the shooting took place yesterday in San Bernardino, California. Oliver Jones, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Intense conversation taking place at our Facebook page. Austin from Clearwater, Florida. What's new? This country needs a sea change. Or Zachary Cooper from Denver. It's our right to be armed. The likelihood of you actually using your firearm in a situation like that is slim. Better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. If everyone starts blaming the weapons for deaths, this country will turn into a police state. I, for one, will take my own safety into my own hands. I carry a gun every day and am willing to protect myself and those around me with whatever means necessary if a basket case shows up with a long gun and a silly vest. Rich Davis responded to that comment with this: I will never understand this. People who want to protect themselves do so out of fear, not to be free. What do you have to say? Give us a call. Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or join the conversation on Facebook.com/TheTakeaway. Early this morning, the British Royal Air Force carried out its first airstrikes on ISIS in Syria, hours after members of parliament voted to expand their fight against the terrorist organization. While the Allies drop bombs from the air, the ISIS fighters hold territory on the ground in Iraq and Syria. In a moment, we shall see how territorial expansion by ISIS gives them greater access to oil. But first, a look at the ISIS bullet train, how ISIS has created a logistical network that can resupply fighters in a matter of hours. Erica Solomon, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, says ISIS is a quick study, scaling up its arms distribution capacity in a way that is changing the nature of warfare in the region.
For a long time, we assumed that ISIS didn't need much because they had captured so much territory. They hold about half of Syria and a third of Iraq, and they've captured lots of armories from Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces, as well as several Iraqi military bases full of millions of dollars of U.S. equipment. But what we found when we were speaking to arms dealers, old arms dealers from the region, is that there's still one thing they need: bullets.
And this is like $1 million a month. That's when they're not even fighting at peak levels?
Right. So what we found, we tried to speak to fighters on the ground, people who had fought with them or are still fighting with them, to ask them, well, how much do you use? And the thing is, even in areas where there was relatively low fighting, such as a typical month in the city of Deir ez-Zor, which is sort of at a standoff right now with the Syrian army, between ISIS and the Syrian army, they were still on some months averaging about $1 million if there were skirmishes in some parts of the front line. And if you just look at a week of a relatively large battle, not a huge one, such as the kind of offensives they sometimes do on the nearby military base, that alone could cost another $1 million in the worth of bullets that they use.
So how does an order get formulated? Who makes the order? Where does it get placed? And then how does the bullet order find its way to the place where it needs to be, according to the ISIS leadership?
It's actually kind of an interesting system. There's a what's called like the higher military council, which is associated with the top leadership, and they have the final say in what's purchased and where it's moved. And they sort of communicate through couriers with what we call the roving committee. This is a group of military commanders who go around Syria and Iraq checking out the battlefronts, figuring out what they need, and also determining prices. So they actually set prices for what they're willing to pay on the typical types of bullets every few days, we found. Arms dealers, who are, you know, typical black market traders who might have been involved in this kind of stuff for years, got approached by ISIS when it took over and basically offered a ticket with a stamp of approval saying you're allowed to buy for us. And they communicate using WhatsApp, actually, which is a free texting application, with different military centers around the region.
And if you're on the border of Turkey and Syria listening to the communications take place, how do you understand that what's going on is arms trading? How did you get some sort of access to essentially a coded radio traffic language?
What I found actually a bit accidentally when I was on the border with Iraq and Syria with the Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga forces, they like to listen in on these ISIS walkie-talkie frequencies, and they kept talking about kebab and salad, and I thought maybe they were ordering lunch, but the Peshmerga said, no, this is some kind of code for weapons. And so I asked fighters who used to fight with ISIS as well as arms dealers, and they said, yeah, that's really common. We changed it around. They told me that kebab, for example, would have probably been some type of anti-aircraft gun weaponry, and salad would be Kalashnikov bullets, probably because there's different types, so it's a mix, like a salad, as one guy told me.
People have the impression that ISIS has changed the game in arms trading in the Middle East, something that's been going on for centuries. And do they have a sense also that ISIS is here to stay?
Problem what we see over and over again when we look at ISIS is how well it manages to enmesh itself within systems that already existed. So whether it's, you know, using local traders to bring in goods, using arms dealers to buy weapons, they sort of co-opt everyone in a way that benefits everyone, and that makes it really hard to find a way to extract them from the picture without hurting all the people that, you know, the international coalition, the Americans, local governments would like to get on their side to help fight them.
Erica Solomon, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Erica Solomon is Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. She spoke to us from Beirut. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
ISIS's bullets and bombs trade is financed by its access to oil, more and more of it. That kind of money can trump a lot of other strategic considerations. For instance, Russian officials have accused Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his family from personally benefiting from oil-to-cash transactions with the so-called Islamic State. President Erdogan called those charges slanderous. Turkey has not lost its moral values, he said, to buy oil from a terrorist organization. He was giving a speech at Qatar University. But Robert Bench, managing partner of Pellicord, an oil and gas company, says the Russian accusations, true or not, indicate that ISIS has gotten to be a big enough player to compete with Moscow in the oil market. Suddenly being a big player, says Bench, poses some problems for ISIS. It may have become too big to fail in the oil trade.
One of their main sources of revenue to fund their operations is oil that has been taken from Syria and Iraq. That production then is sold primarily into the Turkish marketplace as either Iraqi or Kurdish oil, and then that oil makes its way into Turkey and then into Europe.
How do they launder the oil and turn it from ISIS oil into Iraqi or Syrian oil?
It's at the end sales point where that blind eye, as I would call it, is being turned, and Turkey's receiving and or other countries are receiving that oil, and they're not basically looking at or acknowledging where that oil is coming from. They're looking at the proceeds. And so it's not necessarily oil that's coming from the Iraqi oil ministry. It'll come from private producers. They're just not checking to see or caring, more likely, to see whom that producer is that it's coming from, and that's how it is essentially laundered.
Is it your impression that Turkey is dependent on ISIS oil? They could get it from elsewhere, including Russia, for that matter.
Anything that's going to lower their dependence on other countries, especially somebody like Russia, they're going to rely and or need that production. This is production that was coming to them legally at points in time and now is coming to them illegally. That should be sanctioned oil. It's not sanctioned oil. So what you'll have is you'll have some groups that now will continue to purchase that oil and some industrial groups that will not. And that's why you've seen the Russian ministry accuse President Erdogan's son being a direct beneficiary of that. I can't count to the veracity of that story, but I can say with some conviction that there are Turkish groups that are in fact receiving ISIS oil and reselling it into the country.
And they're on Syrian territory, so I'm assuming they acquire facilities in Syria. What is their access to Iraqi oil? Are they drilling or are they coming upon sites in Iraq that are already pumping?
They're acquiring producing assets. They're not like an oil and gas company that has producing assets and they're out there drilling oil and gas wells. What they're doing is they're seizing the entirety of the infrastructure. They're stealing the refineries and they're using all that to produce into Turkey and to other countries.
The way the oil market works, does ISIS have to actually militarily seize a facility in Iraq, or can they just pay to get what it's producing without actually acquiring it militarily?
No, they're acquiring it militarily. There's no intent on ISIS's part to pay somebody for production. They're seizing property. This is a military operation that they're running, and they are then taking those properties, those producing properties and that infrastructure that existed both in Iraq and Syria, and they're then using that for their own purposes.
How much of the Iraqi capacity do you think ISIS has at its disposal right now based on pre-war estimates of what Iraq could have pumped in the old days?
It seems to me the best estimates that we have are in the 25 to 30% range of Iraqi crude that they've been able to abrogate. That's a couple hundred thousand barrels a day.
If they can convert that into cash money almost immediately, how is that getting paid? Is that credits from Turkish banks? Is that cash? Is that dollar transfers through offshore banking institutions?
It's all of the above. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a multi-billion dollar business. This for ISIS is their primary business. Their secondary business, and I've seen figures as high as $1 billion a year, is extortion. But this is their primary source of income.
So who's going to be helping them in the financial world to basically clear these transactions? It can't just be the Turks, right?
No, it's not. And I couldn't necessarily point a finger what's helping the United States and everyone with regard to fighting terrorism are low oil prices. But the problem with that is because of low oil prices, you have ISIS having to seize more oil to continue to finance their operations.
If one was, you know, in Vienna making some sort of financial transaction that involved a purchase or a sale on the oil market, what would you look for if you were trying to figure out if an individual broker or trader had some sort of ISIS connection?
It's quite easy. Where does the crude come from? You have the ability to trace oil from its origin. Now, from a trader standpoint, if I'm dealing with a trader in London or a trader in Geneva that I'm swapping oil with, you're relying upon that trader to give you clean crude. And the trader will know where that crude came from.
So there are people in Geneva and London and possibly even on the COMEC who know what's going on here.
if you're purchasing ISIS oil, you know it. There's no getting around it. There are ways to disguise that. The ways of disguising that right now seem to be the trucking of that oil into Turkey primarily. But ultimately, if you're purchasing that crude, you're going to end up knowing about it, especially if you're the first purchaser.
Robert Bench is managing partner of Pellicord, a Western-owned oil and gas company that works in conflict zones around the world. Multinational cooperation has produced success on the battlefield against Boko Haram, the deadly terrorist organization based in northern Nigeria. More than 900 hostages held by Boko Haram have been reportedly freed in a military sweep by a multinational force in Cameroon last week, the details of which have only just been learned. Here's Cameroon's information minister, Isa Charoma Bakri.
Among the enemies neutralized, we can count Alhaji Gana, known as the head of operations for Boko Haram in the area. He led several attacks against our territory. Large amounts of weapons and ammunition, as well as propaganda material such as jihadist flags, were confiscated during these operations.
Bakari also indicated that 100 fighters were killed in the sweep and as many as 100 more arrested. Alexis Okewo is a staff writer at The New Yorker and has followed Boko Haram's successes and setbacks extensively. Alexis, what's the condition of the hostages? Were they all being held together? 900 is sort of a hard number to imagine in a hostage situation.
It is hard to imagine. And, you know, the military's claim hasn't been independently verified yet. But according to the Cameroonian army, over a three-day operation, it was, as you said, able to raid some Boko Haram camps and capture 900 people who are being held. This is probably one of the largest numbers I've ever heard from a single operation, whether through the Nigerian army or one of its partners being able to release so many people. So, you know, and the news comes one day after there were twin suicide bomb attacks in northern Cameroon. So, you know, while I don't doubt that it happened, it is a large number to imagine.
And this large number is indicative of how these hostages are dealt with. They're being assimilated into the Boko Haram military structure, some of them being compelled to fight, others being compelled to support the operation. Is that a fair statement?
It is. I mean, what was distinctive about the attacks a few days before in northern Cameroon was that they were done by two women, which has also been going on in northern Nigeria. A lot of suicide bomb attacks being carried out by even young girls who are being forced to do this by Boko Haram commanders, among other tasks. So, yeah, a lot of hostages are being forced to fight. They're being forced to carry out attacks and are being treated as fighters.
How much of a setback do we think this sweep by the Cameroon multinational force is? Can we say that Boko Haram has moved into Cameroon, or do these attacks simply suggest that Boko Haram wants to think that they've moved into Cameroon?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Over the past year, Boko Haram has definitely increased its attacks over Nigeria's borders into Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. And northern Cameroon is definitely a vulnerable place to Boko Haram. It clearly has camps there, and it's been fairly easy for them to move in and carry out attacks. I wouldn't say, though, that it's necessarily a major setback for the group, just because despite the Nigerian army being able to also capture hundreds of hostages over the last year and kill a significant amount of members, the group has still been doing things like burning down a major military base a few days ago in northeastern Nigeria and carrying out attacks on soft civilian targets. So just when we think that the army has made some kind of breakthrough, the group manages to come back again and launch some kind of attack.
Is there greater clarity on what Boko Haram's mission is, what its message is, what it's actually trying to accomplish?
Now that it has declared allegiance to the Islamic State just this past spring, it seems that their original mission of wanting to create an Islamic State is now their only, at least most stated goal. And that's what seems to be motivating them. They were able to hold territory in northeastern Nigeria last year, and it seems like they still want to. They want to regain that foothold.
Alexis Okewo is a staff writer at The New Yorker reporting on Boko Haram in Nigeria and Africa. Thanks so much, Alexis.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on travel tips, Tabata training, toy making, and more. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Chinese leaders are in Africa trying to keep momentum going on a cooperation strategy more than 6 years in the making, the sixth forum on China-Africa cooperation. This year's drearily corporate-sounding theme, China-Africa progressing together, win-win cooperation for common development. Chinese President Xi Jinping is leading the meeting where African leaders are lined up to make friends, like Zimbabwe's president earlier this week when Xi Jinping was in Harare.
Mr. President, I'm glad that Zimbabwe and China speak the same language on many issues. We share the same conviction that only a fair, just, and non-prescriptive world order based on the principles of the Charter of the United Nations, can deliver the development we all need.
The Chinese leader and Mugabe just signed 12 agreements worth more than $4 billion. The U.S. wants nothing to do with Mugabe and his dictatorship, but does acting out of principle put the U.S. at a disadvantage? Do African nations view China as just another colonial power with deep pockets? Or has China managed to get something right in its dealings with African nations? Darren Acemoglu is professor of economics at MIT and author of Why Nations Fail. Professor, does China have something right here in dealing with the African nations?
Well, it has two things. It has huge demand, and African nations need that demand. But, you know, that needs to be qualified, and I'll qualify it in a second. And it has a much more robust stomach when it comes to corruption, human rights abuses, and unsavory dictators. So this is a potent mix.
Is that to say that China is trying to maintain the status quo in its economic leverage because these are reliable partners? Or does China view its influence as a force for change in Africa?
I'm not sure that China views its influence as an agent of political change. You know, if you look at recent Chinese history, you know, there isn't anything that the Chinese leadership is more averse to than political change.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think that they're ever going to be, you know, asking for political change from another country, especially since, you know, they are not willing to think about it at home, and they have made a very vocal sort of point in the past that they do not want to interfere in other countries' businesses. But on the other hand, they do want to change the infrastructure. They do want to change the supply chain in African nations so that they can be more effective in delivering their natural resources.
Does that have the impact of increasing prosperity in African nations? And are people in Africa satisfied and enthusiastic about that? Or do they view China as another colonial power who's there to get rich quick and leave?
I wish I could give a clear answer to that. You know, I think it's more a little bit more nuanced because, you know, all else equal, you know, over the last 20 years, I think the Chinese relations for African nations have been a force towards greater GDP. Why? Because, you know, African nations export natural resources and export agriculture. And there has been a huge demand coming from China, and this has helped their exports. Sometimes the Chinese have gone around and built roads and infrastructure, and that's probably not a bad thing either. But I think you looked at it from the longer perspective, it's probably not as good a deal for Africans. You know, here, you know, you have to take some sides. You have to have a perspective. But, you know, my perspective is very clear from my research and from the book Why Nations Fail that I wrote with James Robinson. You know, Africa needs better governance to grow. It needs better institutions. And what, you know, the evidence is pretty clear on this is that the Chinese not only don't help the building of better institutions, but often they actually ossify the existing institutional status quo. I mean, you could see that with Zimbabwe. You could see that in the last 15 years with Sudan, where, you know, after Sudan, following, you know, a horrific set of, you know, human rights abuses, was cut off from all Western relations. You know, the Chinese not only stepped up to the plate to fully trade with them, but started supplying arms to al-Bashir's regime, and the same thing in Angola. So I think it's very clear that, you know, the Chinese are not interested in, you know, being the agent of institutional change, but they do value a strong government that they can rely and do business with and perhaps pay bribes to.
Does the Chinese leadership view different African nations differently? Can we look at the way in which these deals are made country to country, as opposed to just, you know, collectively lumping everyone together, because Africa is a huge place, of course?
Well, I mean, of course, China is most interested in the countries that have natural resources, and they have, you know, been investing a lot in Africa. So they are very good at finding the right set of deals to make. You know, some places require arms and, you know, some sort of international relation, like Sudan. Some other places are really craving infrastructural investment, and the Chinese are good at sort of doing those early stage infrastructural investments, especially when they bring their own people, which is, you know, pretty good deal for them in some respects, not so good for some of the Chinese who have to spend time in Africa and they keep complaining. So it's not the case that, you know, the Westerners are being prescriptive, like Mugabe suggested in that clip you played, and the Chinese people are, you know, in unison, you know, supporting the relationship. I think there are a lot of opposition voices within Africa.
Darren Acemoglu is economics professor at MIT and author of Why Nations Fail. He spoke with us from Cambridge. Thanks so much, Darren.
Oh, thanks, John. It's a great pleasure.
Future Earthlings may be in a position to look back at the early days of this century and wonder about the forks in the road we faced. There were a lot of them. Was it our response or tolerance of terrorism and gun violence that mostly shaped the 21st century? Was it the late human response to climate change? Or will it be something quietly revolutionary just now bursting into view? If something called CRISPR, which stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, takes off — you can just call it genetic editing — if CRISPR takes off, it might produce far bigger changes in this century than climate and guns. CRISPR is a technology for altering DNA quickly and more precisely than anything available up until now. It's possible, in fact, to imagine this editing technology enabling scientists to alter DNA or organisms and their descendants nearly as easily as you can edit video on a smartphone or a desktop computer loaded with Final Cut Pro. A conference in Washington, D.C. this week is trying to think ahead of this technology before, shall we say, the cat is out of the bag. Professor Jennifer Doudna discovered CRISPR in her laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley. She joins us from Washington, D.C., where the conference wraps up today. Jennifer, welcome and congratulations on your discovery.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
And this discovery was an example of science funded in the public interest, right?
That's right. A curiosity-driven project funded by the National Science Foundation.
Have I oversold the case for what this might eventually be able to allow people to do on their desktops?
Well, I like your analogy because I think it's a good way of explaining what we're trying to do with this technology. But the truth is that, you know, it's a complicated procedure, and it involves manipulating the DNA in cells in a very precise fashion to make specific changes to the code of life.
And you can do this in individual organisms. That would be somatic changes. And what kinds of therapies can you develop or envision with this technique, just thinking about single organisms?
Well, scientists are very excited about the potential to correct mutations that cause genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis or Duchenne muscular dystrophy or sickle cell anemia. These are all diseases where it's been known for quite a while what the underlying genetic basis is, but until now we have not had a way to precisely change or fix that mutation.
And that would mean going into lung tissue of someone with cystic fibrosis and altering the genetic code, and then the replacement cells in that organism would not have the cystic fibrosis problem?
That's the idea.
I see. And this could be a treatment for some kinds of cancer as well?
I think for cancer, the idea is to use this as a way to help harness the patient's immune system to attack cancer cells.
And in fact, this uses an immune system that's already working in bacteria, right? It's you're basically taking something that's already in nature.
That's correct.
And what is the kind of out of control worry in a particular organism? I mean, how do you know that the change that you're making is going to stay that change and not become something else, even inside someone with cystic fibrosis?
Well, this is one of the things that makes this technology so exciting, is that it's precise and it makes a permanent change. And then once that change is made, that's it. And so we can be confident that, you know, that change is going to persist in a tissue or an organism.
Among the issues being talked about at this conference is researchers who claim that they can alter the DNA of pigs in what's called the germline, which would affect the descendants, and produce a strain of pigs that can produce organisms that are transplantable into humans. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And what's the fear of that? I mean, that sounds beneficial, not necessarily for the pigs, and there's all kinds of I can hear the questions being asked about pigs, but still, what's your response to what that might mean for human beings?
I think that kind of application is very exciting, and I don't think we're concerned particularly about that. This conference was really about discussing applications in the germline, meaning making changes that would be permanent not only in a person but also in their descendants.
And that would mean doing CRISPR editing in individual sperm cells and egg cells in humans. Is that research permissible right now? Is it being done?
No, it's not permissible right now with public funds.
But it is being done maybe with private funds somewhere in the world.
It could be.
And is part of the concern about this technology that it is more portable than some of the other techniques? You described it as very complicated, but I noticed that there is a company that's, I believe, looking for crowdsourced funding that would produce more readily available kits to produce this in labs outside of the University of California, Berkeley. Does that worry you at all?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think this is one of the things that, again, scientists are excited about and also, you know, appreciate the power of, is that this is a technology that is widely available now to scientists. Actually, even without your kit, you know, scientists can get access to this relatively easily through organizations like AdGene, which is a nonprofit that distributes research materials. And so it means that, you know, it's widely available. It's a technology that works in essentially every type of cell and organism where it's been tested. And it's, for the most part, highly accurate and effective. So it's very exciting, but it's also very powerful.
How do you compare the notion and responsible discussion of ethics at this conference to, say, conferences that took place in the 70s that tried to create a sort of baseline operating set of rules for gene splicing when that technology became evident in the 1970s?
Right. Well, I think this is a meeting that is very much building on that tradition of scientists taking responsibility for their work, discussing it publicly, and trying to come to a consensus about how to proceed, you know, in a scientific setting. And we're seeing that here with this meeting. I think what's very interesting is that, you know, the world has changed since the 70s. It's a global world now in terms of the scientific community. We see very rapid dissemination of information, especially over social media.
You're not wearing a headband like you did in the 70s.
Right? I'm not, but yeah. But I could be.
Yeah.
And you know, so I think it's fascinating. And unlike the Asilomar meeting of the 1970s, this conference is truly international. And in fact, it's sponsored by not only the U.S. Academies of Science, but also the Royal Society in the United Kingdom, as well as the Chinese Academy of Sciences.
Jennifer Doudna discovered the CRISPR technique in her laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley. That technique and its implications is being discussed at a conference in Washington, D.C. that wraps up today. Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
So who might want harvestable organs from pigs? A new heart, perhaps, for former Vice President Dick Cheney, who believes he has some unfinished business yet to do? A more traditional form of immortality was unveiled today at the U.S. Capitol, an official bust of the former representative, cabinet official, vice president, and as VP, the president of the Senate, Dick Cheney.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney.
Senator John McCain will welcome the new face in the Senate corridors, even if he occasionally mutters an old argument from the old days.
Obviously, he and I had disagreements, particularly on the conduct of the Iraq War and specifically on torture. But overall, I think he's provided honorable service. I think he's a dedicated American, and I consider him a friend, even though we've had disagreements over certain specific issues. Certainly the issue of Iraq War is associated with that. But over time, people judge people in their entirety. And some people, frankly, suffer by that over the years, and some people don't. I think history will judge him very well, because he did a lot of other things besides just being vice president.
Senator McCain putting torture behind us at the U.S. Capitol. Easy for him, perhaps. Thanks to our own Todd Zwillick for getting that comment for us on this Cheney or Bust Day on Capitol Hill. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.